Hey, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Sorry about the last couple of days worth of technical difficulties up here, but I think I got it all ironed out now. Oh no, Dershowitz is on CNN. That's just made my stomach turn over real quick when I glanced up and there was the Dersh. I don't know what he's yelling about, but I'm sure it's evil. All right, well, anyway. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. Kevin Zeese is going to be on the show today to talk about the Syria talks. Now, the only journalist I know has really been covering the Syria talks is Roy Guttman, but I don't really feel like arguing with the dude. I know that he's a good reporter, but he's kind of wacky. I don't know. Anyway. But Kevin Zeese, man, he wrote this thing. It's good. I liked it. And then I called him and said, hey, do the show. And he said, all right. So that's going to happen. Also, I guess I did get a little sidetracked. I'm going to continue to see if I can get a hold of Michael Bolden from the 10th Amendment Center. We've got some very important things to discuss. I guess I'll have to remember at the break to get back to it. I might forget. We'll see what happens. All right, anyway. So here, let me write a note to myself. Here, microphone. But then also, I haven't been able to really do radio very good, very much, in a couple of days. And so, I have a lot of things that I want to cover on the show before the week is over. And it's almost over. Oh, by the way. Before I get to those things, you should know that Sunday morning on KPFK, on anti-war radio, my guest will be, Peter something or other. But anyway, the point is, he's this British guy who's been living in Thailand for, I guess, maybe the last 40 years or 50 years, I don't know. Anyway, his whole thing is journalism. About on the subject of the aftermath, really, the remaining remnants of America's war in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And he did this, you may have seen it. It was kind of one of those photo essays sort of a things that they featured in The Diplomat about the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And anyway, very interesting history. And should be a very interesting conversation. So that'll be Sunday morning on 90.7 FM KPFK in Los Angeles. In fact, I actually sent him this movie. He hadn't seen it before, but I only recently saw it. And someone by way of Twitter had sent it to me, so thanks whoever you were who sent it to me. And I'm not exactly sure of the exact title of the movie. The way it's titled on YouTube is kind of weird, but probably it will come right up if you just use the term bombies, especially if you look for video. Bombies, I-E-S. And that's a reference to, I would have called them bomblets. Thought they were called bomblets. You know, when a cluster bomb breaks open and then 100 little bombs come out. Well, the duds are whatever error rate of duds are there just laying around. And hundreds of people a year are still killed. Hundreds a year. Are still killed by unexploded, up until now, ordnance in Southeast Asia there, left over from the war. And especially these cluster bombs. Well, anyway, they do terrible damage. And so that's part of the legacy of the war there in Laos. And anyway, so he's going to be on Peter Sumner Ruther, and it's going to be great. So listen to that. That's Sunday morning, 8:30 to 9 Pacific time on KPFK. 90.7 FM in LA, if you're in LA, or actually, it's repeated all over Southern California on 98.7 and 90, this and that and the other thing. You just have to look at kpfk.org, but really, you can hear it from Mexico up to past Santa Barbara. So, and quite a ways out to sea. All right, so, that's the KPFK show. Okay, so now the news I wanted to cover. One of the things when I was complaining yesterday about how American intervention is what caused the terror war against us in the first place, and then that became the excuse for our terror war back and all of that, the most important point that I was supposed to say to prove how smart I am about it or whatever is that the president himself now admits it in trying to draw a comparison contrast between himself and his predecessor, which can get confusing sometimes. He looks a lot like George W. Bush in terms of his policy. But, well, in a lot of other ways, I guess. But he says here, I mean, think of both of their associations to Dick Cheney. Barack Obama is Dick Cheney's, what, second or eighth cousin or some kind of thing like that. And George Bush made him vice president. So they do have a lot in common. But anyway, so here's Obama in the State of the Union speech the other day. And the whole first part of this sentence is wrong, but, you know, if he's going to say anything true, it's got to have a lie at the beginning. We must fight the battles that need to be fought, he lied. But then he continued, comma, not those that terrorists prefer from us. Large-scale deployments that drain our strength and may ultimately feed extremism. Huh. You don't say. As in, invading Iraq and creating a giant civil war that lasted for 8 years and gave thousands and thousands and thousands of young Sunni jihadists battlefield experience in their war against the American occupation and the American-Iranian effort to install the Shiite Arabs in power in Baghdad. To this day, the Anbar province is stateless territory, basically. And the so-called Islamic State of Iraq, which is just al-Zarqawi's group, they have the run of the place. Not that they run it, but they're free. And they've been fighting in Syria, crossing the border at will and going to Syria to fight, where, you know, America supports their efforts there as the Sunni insurgency against the Shiite government there. Trying to make up for past screw-ups, I guess. But anyway, large-scale deployments drain America's strength. Yeah, that's a nice euphemism for thousands of dead young American sons of somebody, brothers of somebody, nephews of somebody who are dead in the last few wars. And may ultimately feed extremism. May. This is as close as we're ever going to get to honesty from Barack Obama. But this is where we get back to the real point about the franchising of Al-Qaeda, as the New York Times called it. On September 12th, 2001, Al-Qaeda was a few hundred men, 200 or 300 friends of Osama. And then the CIA went in there with their laser designators, and the Air Force went in there with their heavy bombers, and reduced a few hundred men to about 80, maybe less, a few dozen. And then Donald Rumsfeld basically just called off the war at Tora Bora and let them escape. And whether you think that's because he's the lousiest person ever to exist, and that was the very best he could do, when any of us could have ordered the Marines to keep going and not just stand there, or whether you think they deliberately let Osama bin Laden go so they could have a Goldstein enemy of the state to chase around in vain for 10 years and try to, you know, confuse you with Saddam Hussein and all this crap. Bin Laden spent the next 10 years in exile, in hiding. And by, I guess they say in 2005 is when he ended up in Abbottabad. His Islamo-fascist caliphate was isolated to the attic of this house in the suburbs with basically no connection really to what was going on with Al-Qaeda anymore. And, you know, other than as an observer. So in other words, even if they'd let him escape, if they just left it at that, the terror war would have been over. Al-Qaeda would have been gone. Any Zarqawiite wannabe bin Laden anywhere west of Afghanistan would have been hunted down and killed by either the Ayatollahs in Iran or Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the kings of Arabia, or the Assad-Baathist regime in Syria, where, of course, George Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and Dick Cheney and George Tenet had a deal with Bashar al-Assad that he would keep al-Qaeda down for us and torture them to death, including innocent mistaken identity people like Mara Rahr and others who lived but was still tortured by Bashar al-Assad. And there never would have been a franchising out of al-Qaeda. You look at them spreading across the Maghreb and throughout the Middle East, it's from the Iraq war they're spreading, not from Afghanistan. It's from what America did in Iraq. So the president's right about that. That's what al-Qaeda wanted from George W. Bush, and he gave it to them.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right of the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Kevin Zeese is coming up to talk about the Syria talks. That's a big deal. That should be a good interview. Good old Kevin, man. He's good on everything, dude. Has been. No, that's not right. He's good on everything foreign policy. He's a progressive type, not a libertarian, but he's good on the wars. And this piece that he wrote on Syria, co-authored with somebody or other there, really good stuff. So that's going to be cool coming up here in just a minute. So now, let me go through because I got a lot to talk about. Well, let's see. I'll save all the serious stuff for Kevin there. Here's some stories out of Iraq. Iraq military retakes areas west of Baghdad, seizes small town near Ramadi, dubbed important al-Qaeda base. So they're somewhat attempting to take back up the occupation of the Anbar province. Remember, it's half a year ago or more, right? Last summer. I think it was probably August, right? August, September, something like that. Patrick Coburn came on the show. Patrick Coburn, i.e., a.k.a. the authoritative source. He came back from Iraq and said, hey, I just got back from Iraq, and the Iraqi army has withdrawn from the Anbar province. They are not attempting to enforce their monopoly on power out of Baghdad onto Anbar. It's basically an autonomous zone for now. And that is because they're taking licks and they don't have the ability to withstand it. So they retreated. What are they going to stand there for and get sniped at when they don't have the force to go out there and actually take over the place? Remember, the same Sunni-based insurgency fought the Americans to a standstill. The only thing that ended their insurgency against us was they had lost Baghdad, so they had too many enemies. They needed to reduce their number of enemies, so they decided they would keep the Shiite Arab parties we put in power as their enemies. They would stop fighting our guys if we would stop fighting them. And Petraeus paid them and gave them AK-47s. So that was how he beat the insurgency, is he sat down at a table and made a deal with them. In fact, man, I forget now where the footnote is on this, the source on this, but it was kind of, you know, secondhandly reported that David Petraeus, I think this was Petraeus's people in his PR machine, explained that he sat George Bush down and said, now look, all that stuff about victory over the Sunni insurgency, that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is I'm going to make a deal with them. And then we're at least going to try to shore up the guys that we like the most within the political parties. And that is, they're going to try to take it to Sadr and weaken his position within the United Iraqi Alliance, which, of course, never even worked anyway. But that was, you know, by the time the surge started, the war with this, virtually the war with the Sunni insurgency was over by then. They were already making that deal. But so, anyway, point being that if Petraeus couldn't whoop the Sunni insurgency, then, of course, neither can Maliki's army that Petraeus trained up for him. They can hold on to Baghdad. They've won Baghdad, and they're not going to lose it to some suicide bombers now. But they're not going to really control Anbar anymore. So, you know, whether or not you set the world's worst, you know, social engineers onto this to make it worse deliberately or not, or what, like that article we talked about yesterday at Juan Cole's blog, where the guy's advising against deliberately balkanizing the Middle East. It's already a done deal, man. It's already falling apart. And, you know, well, anyway, you got Maliki now is proposing to create new provinces for Iraq. Speaking of balkanization here, they want to create basically Assyrian Christian and Turkmen provinces in Iraq and divide the society even further. And the Kurds are angry and saying all this is just a ruse so that Maliki has a direct channel to funnel arms and fighters to Bashar al-Assad in Syria, his ally. Remember, America helped Iran install the Shiite parties in power in Baghdad. So they're part of that Shiite axis with Hezbollah and the Baathists in Syria. So America fights against the Sunni insurgency in Iraq and for it in Syria. And so here we have al-Qaeda guys controlling this border. Maliki's coming up with this plan to try to carve out some new provinces for, I guess, just as the legal fiction around his supply routes to try to back Assad and Hezbollah in their war against America and Saudi Arabia's jihadists there. What a mess. And you know what? Maybe it's all some brilliant divide and conquer thing. It seems more slapdash and haphazard to me. After all, I mean, it was Douglas Feith and Paul Bremer who made the call. And if Douglas Feith made the call, then that means it was probably Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz, right? Who made the call to disband the Iraqi army and to outright outlaw all Baathists from any government office whatsoever. To basically, upon the invasion, to completely abolish the Iraqi state and start over. And then, you know, they had their hand-picked caucus system. But what happened is the Ayatollah Sistani, who, you know, they don't claim he's magic like in Catholicism, but it's still, you know, with a direct line to God and all of that. But just he's not a priest, but he is. The comparison is still there as far as the rank among the Shia. Ayatollah Sistani is not the most powerful political leader. That would be the Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran. But the Ayatollah Sistani is the most, the highest-ranking Shiite religious cleric who is Iranian and who's living in the south. And in January of 2004, he said, hey, all Shiites, if you believe in God, I need you to go outside and demand one man, one vote. So they did, all of them. And the message was clear to Bush that, do you want to start this war all over again? These were the people that Bush had, you know, overthrown Saddam, and they were happy to see Saddam overthrown. You know, they basically stood back and let the invasion happen. And then they told them, you want to start the war all over again? Or you're going to really mean what, we're going to make you mean what you say about democracy here. And then that's it. From there, majority rule. And of course, the security situation was so bad, nobody could even put their names on the ballots. Because they'd just get assassinated. So everybody could only run as the slate. Let's run as the United Iraqi Alliance, meaning the Shiite Arabs. In fact, that first big election in 2005, I'll never get over even John Stewart, who he should have known better by then. He had done enough coverage of the Iraq War by then. But even John Stewart was going, wow, purple-fingered elections. isn't it beautiful and impressive, and maybe all of us critics were wrong after all, or whatever. Well, the Sunnis boycotted that thing, they'd have lost anyway. They boycotted that thing, and all that did was set the stage for the civil war to come. Now that they had won the election, and the Shiites were the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council in alliance with the Sadrists, they were the government. What do you think they're going to do? Share their newfound power with all the Sunnis that they're taking it from in the first place? Man. So anyway, it's a disaster. You know, Maliki is also a Dawa Party guy. These are the Iraqis who were the Iraqi traitors back when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan supported Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran to contain the Iranian Revolution, the policy that George Bush Jr. reversed. These were the Iraqi traitors who fled to Iran and fought on Iran's side against Iraq. Which you can kind of see, maybe it makes a little bit of sense for him to do so, since these are more British-drawn borders than real ones, but, I mean, Persia's Persia and Iraq's Iraq, right? That's a real line somewhere in there. Oh, well. So that's the story out of Iraq. The last year has been the most violent year since 2008. As, you know, like I tried to tell you all along, the search never was working, and it never did work. Me and a lot of other people debunked it all in real time, the whole time, whether the surge was working or could work or would work or anything like that. The bribes worked temporarily, but the so-called point of the surge was that, you know, democracy in the American sense of the word doesn't just mean majority rule. It's supposed to mean, you know, open participation for everybody, right? Voting rights and minority and individual rights protected no matter what the majority says or wants. You at least still get to have some part in it and power sharing this, that, the other, right? Yeah. But the Shiites, they never intended to share power with the Sunnis. They never did. I mean, Petraeus' promise that, oh, yeah, you know, I'll let you patrol your own neighborhoods, but then don't worry. Maliki's going to deputize the lot of you and make you all de facto, you know, Iraqi government agents, either soldiers or police, and bring you into the government. That was never going to happen. And the people who aren't stupid never believed that it was going to happen. And mocked and ridiculed that ridiculous goal back then because it was so obviously not going to happen. And that was the entire basis for the myth of the surge working, was that these compromises eventually would be made. And so, there you go. Abject and complete and total failure. Maliki has not ever included, never mind including them into the security, so-called security forces, he hadn't included them into the government at all. He had his own vice president arrested for being a Sunni, or put a warrant out for him. The guy fled. And so now, I guess the Sunni tribes, they're sick of waiting around. They're going back to war to try to take back what's theirs. And you know, with Saudi money, maybe they can do it. And kill a lot of people trying. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, on the Liberty Express, libertyexpressradio.com. The great Alan Butler and family over there at libertyexpressradio.com. Also at dailypaul.com, or dailypaulradio.com, I guess that is. Sorry about that. And, yeah, and like that. So good. ScottHorton.org, that's my site. Okay, our guest today... looks like he'll be the only guest today. It's our friend Kevin Zeese. Welcome back to the show. Kevin, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Now, so I'm sorry, I don't have it prepared. I need to try to think off of the top of my head about your bio. You're a lawyer, and you're on the board of the Save Chelsea Manning thing, right?
That's right. And my main project is Popular Resistance, which is a site about the resistance movement in the United States and around the world. It's popularresistance.org. I'm also in the steering committee of Come Home America, which is trying to unite the right and left against war. And I'm also a co-director of It's Our Economy, which is an effort to democratize the economy. So I got a few balls in the air.
All right. Now, yeah, Come Home America, that to me is the most important project of all. I wish I had $1 zillion, man. I would put $1 zillion behind Come Home America and make that the thing.
Money would make a difference. There's no question about it. And all these projects, the resources are needed to really help good people do good work.
Yep. And, Come Home America, the left and right libertarian coalition, we don't care what you believe about anything except let's all agree, let's end these wars. Let's roll back this empire and let's do it right now. That's good stuff. All right, comehomeamerica.us, that is, everybody. All right, good. So, Kevin, now, you've got a piece here with Margaret Flowers. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar here, but it ran in Truthout, correct? And it's going to run at antiwar.com.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's running in a bunch of outlets. It's basically looking at the Syrian so-called peace process.
Uh-huh. It's called...
And, sometimes they tell us something is for one thing and it's actually for another. It happens quite often, actually.
Well, hang on. Let me make sure everybody's got the title to Google up while we're talking here. Is Syrian Peace Conference Laying the Foundation for War? That's the title of the article here. And now, so yes, saying one thing and doing another, please explain.
Well, that's I think, one of the biggest problems we face in understanding what's going on around us. The government and the corporate mass media puts out a line, that we're going to war for democracy, right? Or we're going to increase employment by passing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or we're going to have a Syrian peace process to prevent war. Often the truth is the opposite. And I think the way the Syrian peace process has developed is quite evident that there's no real likelihood of finding any peace in this process. And that what it's really doing is laying the foundations for war. And there are a number of reasons that why we come to that conclusion. And so we put it out there so people would in the anti-war movement would start to prepare for what we see as it's going to be a coming drumbeat for war. We need to stop the attack on Syria once again.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, that's an important point that, people got to those of us who are going to stay good on this, we've got to have our arguments in a row so that, we can't be intimidated out of the debate by the war party.
Exactly. We have to, it's so important. I mean, a lot of our job as activists is to let people, see the truth, lift the veil so we can see what's happening. And there are basically three reasons why we think this peace process is doomed to failure. First, they cut out Iran. Now, Iran, they have Saudi Arabia in there, they have France in there, they have all sorts of countries are part of this peace process, but Iran was invited and then disinvited. Disinvited because the United States and its Syrian opposition group, wanted Iran out. And so they took Iran out. I mean, that was a terrible error that showed that this is a rigged process. They only want one result, and Iran has to leave because it opposes that result. The second reason why we see failure is because of who else was not invited. There has been a civil society opposition to Assad that existed before this war began. And that civil society is not included in these negotiations. So Syrians who've been working for transformation have not been included. Second, a lot of on-the-ground fighters are not included. There's only one opposition group included, and that's one that has been endorsed by the United States. And anyone else who has not been endorsed by the Western powers is excluded. And now that leads to a real problem, because let's say they negotiate a peace or a ceasefire or, you know, some kind of stopping of the war for a short time. The people who are in that room aren't all fighting the war. In fact, the main fighters are outside of that room. And so Assad agrees to a peace process, and then on the ground, in reality, those who are not in that room continue the war. So then Assad responds when he's attacked, and the United States says, you're violating the peace agreement, and that the only way to enforce that is to go to war. And so it's almost a guarantee for Assad to face military attack by the United States if he agrees to peace in this process. And the third thing, and most important reason why this really is a fraud, is because the United States and the one Syrian opposition group that's there has been insisting that before negotiations can begin, Assad has to agree to leave government. And, you know, they claim it's based on the preconditions for this meeting, the Geneva Accords that led to this meeting. And of course, if you read those agreements, there's nothing in there about Assad leaving. There's talk of a transformation of the government, but it doesn't say Assad can't be part of that government. So it's a false statement by John Kerry. It's a false statement by the Syrian opposition that the United States supports. And it's a false basis for negotiation. The United States government, Israel, Saudi Arabia have wanted the Assads out since before the current Assad, going back to his father. And this is a long-term geopolitical goal because Syria is very important to Russia and very important to Iran, two countries the United States is in opposition with. And so this is really about the U.S. getting more control over the region, Saudi Arabia and Israel getting what they want, and weakening Russia and Iran. And so the precondition of having Assad leave shows that this is really a phony negotiation. And again, that presents an opportunity for an excuse for war. You can see the U.S. mass media saying something like, Assad refuses to participate in the peace process. He refuses to agree to the conditions that were set by all the parties. You know, it would be a lie, but our media lies to us often. And so for those three reasons, the Assad factor, the lack of inclusion of Syrian civil society and the fighters on the ground, and the exclusion of Iran, this peace process is a fraud, and it's really designed to lay the groundwork for U.S. military intervention in the region. Mm-hmm.
In other words, in a short time from now, John Kerry will be saying, look, we tried to deal with them, but you can't deal with Bashar al-Assad.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
Okay,
and
now...
Kerry,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No.
Well, I was going to say Kerry has just like been proven that so far in his term as Attorney General, as Secretary of State, to really be a big war supporter. When the last round of the Syrian war was popping up, he was pushing war much more aggressively than the Pentagon was. The Pentagon was trying to hold him back, explaining why it couldn't work, why it was a bad idea, why it would be counterproductive, but Kerry was pushing hard for war. You saw in those hearings before Congress, Defense Secretary Hagel being pretty silent, the military command being pretty silent, and John Kerry doing all the talking for war.
Right. Yeah, and it's funny, too, because here he is. He's at least, I don't want to get too far diverted off onto the separate subjects, but as far as Kerry goes, he's at least kind of halfway pushing to try to have a peace deal in Palestine and a peace deal with Iran. And, of course, the whole point, like you're saying, or a huge part of why to work toward the overthrow or at least the diminishing of the power of the Baathists in Syria is to hurt the Iranians. At the same time, he's the one trying to make peace with them harder than anybody else in D.C. What the hell's that?
That's exactly true. And as far as Israel and Iran, I think we've got to watch those processes closely, too. You've got to really doubt what the U.S. government says they're doing, when they're doing it, and really look close to see what's really going on.
Right. And we can get back to those subjects later on, too. But I want to make sure we get all this, the Geneva stuff covered. Now, first of all, what you say about Kerry invoking the Geneva One Accord, as saying that Assad must go. It doesn't say Assad must go. It says there will be some kind of transitional this, that, the other thing. Now, the Syrians themselves signed on to that back at Geneva 1, correct? Assad signed on to that?
Not only did they sign on, but Russia signed on. Now, Russia is Syria's closest ally.
See, that's what I thought, was that the Syrians had agreed, Assad himself had agreed, that he would end up leaving power at the end of the transition to the new regime. Or he was willing to agree to that before they even came up with all the steps of what it's going to look like after he's gone.
It actually didn't say that. It didn't say Assad would agree to leave. It said there'd be a transition in government. That could merely mean new elections. And Assad could be a candidate. It doesn't mean Assad's not
going to.
We don't know what that means. And I think what the
discrepancy was just whether it means now or ever, but you're saying it doesn't say that at all.
Assad leaving. Yeah. That's right. It doesn't even say Assad leaving. It doesn't even say Assad would leave.
And, of course, if they held elections in Syria right now, he'd win hands down.
Well, who knows? But I think that's probably a good guess. I mean, there are people who support him there. And his family's been in power for a long time, and that carries a lot of weight with people who live in countries. But, so who knows what it would mean. I don't know whether he'd be winning an election or not. I have not polled the Syrian people. I have not seen any polls of the Syrian people, so... Who knows? And he certainly has made some mistakes, serious mistakes, as president too. So if there was a real campaign, who knows what could happen.
Yeah. Well, I don't think hardly anybody there likes him, but there are a lot of people who prefer him to a good beheading. So,
well, the alternative is always in elections. The alternatives always matter. You may not like the incumbent, but the alternative may be worse.
That's true. In fact, all the complaint I do about Obama, can you imagine if it had been John McCain all this time, how many of us would already burn to death in nuclear fireballs by now? Holy moly.
Or Hillary Clinton. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of worse choices. I mean, Obama is, disappointing to a lot of people for good reason. I don't use the word disappointing because I never expected much from him, but I think he's made a ton of mistakes and a very disappointing president. He's not done very well. Missed tremendous opportunities on really solving economic problems and ending wars. He just didn't make it happen. And so he's been really bad. But there's so many worse choices, from Romney and McCain to Clinton, all who ran against him. I don't think they'd be doing any better, and they'd probably be doing worse.
All right, now let me ask you this. Tea leaves, Kremlinology kind of a thing without anything real definitive. It seems like, crap, now we got to go out to this break. Well, my question going out to this break is, it sort of seemed like some Israelis and Democrats in D.C. were getting it through their stupid skulls that backing al-Qaeda in Syria actually is not a very good idea, and that maybe they would change their policy or at least, tone
it
down.
But, right.
We'll find out what you think of that when we get back from this break.
Okay.
It's the great Kevin Zeese from comehomeamerica.us. Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonks.org/liberty. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Kevin Zeese from comehomeamerica.us and popularresistance.org and other URLs like that. He's got this piece running at Truth Out. It'll be at antiwar.com tomorrow. Well, what the hell did I do with it? Here it is. It's called, Is the Syrian Peace Conference Really Laying the Foundation for War? And so let me set that question up here again real quick. Kevin, we've been talking about this. I've been talking about this with you and with other people on the show for years and years and years, going way, way back, about how any of these neocons who think that they're going to get a regime change in Syria and get anything like what anything that would be acceptable to them after a regime change in Syria they must be crazy. Their plan for Iraq was they were going to get a Hashemite king like in Jordan, a different minority emperor backed by the United States to rule and lord it over the Shiite minority. If you read David Wimser talking about how, oh, don't worry, the Shiites love the Hashemite kings and all that, it'd be great. Well, no, they just turned the whole country over to Iran. It's not a de facto Israeli emirate like Jordan. It's an Iranian one, or at least most of it is. So these guys, all they're expediting the chaotic collapse and whatever. They don't know what the hell they're doing. They never get what they want. And anyone for years could have told them, if they listened to this show, they could have heard people on this show saying, well, me, saying, look, your best chance, if you get rid of the Baathists, if you're lucky, would be to get the Muslim Brotherhood. That's if you're lucky. Those guys would be the moderates. But more likely, you're going to be dealing with a bunch of suicide bomber kooks left over from the Iraq War and whatever. I mean, this is all so foreseeable. And yet, the policy has been, well, you can describe it in your own terms if you want, but it seems to me like the policy's been for 2.5, going on 3 years now, that America and Saudi Arabia support the jihadists in their work to overthrow Assad. But then, oh, and this is what I was going to say and was saying before the break. It seems like they kind of finally started maybe going back through the archives and listening to some stuff from 6 years ago telling them not to do this. Because they're saying, well, geez, the Israelis and the Americans too, saying, huh, well, maybe if we got rid of the Baathists and we just had a bunch of suicide bombers on our northern border, that actually maybe that would not be preferable to our current situation. So I just wonder, you know, what you think of it. I mean, it seems like, you know, John Kerryan got the memo, if that is right at all. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think the United States has a very confused foreign policy, and it's the United States Empire is not as strong as it thought it would be in this time of a one superpower world. They really thought they could dictate and get what they wanted, and they've now discovered in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya that, you know, they can go to war, they can explode a lot of things, destroy a lot of things, but they can't put in place a government that necessarily will agree with them. But I think they also have the conclusion that if they can't put the government in place they want, it's better to have these governments that oppose them out, so that if the country's in chaos, in civil war, in tribal war, divided, weakening itself by internal factions, that's better than having someone in office who opposes their agenda. They at least neutralize that country. Yeah. And I think that's
but now let me ask
policy.
You this. In what way does Syria oppose America or Israel's agenda? They torture who they're told to torture. They haven't said a word about the Golan Heights in 20 years or whatever. I mean, what's the problem?
And you could say the same thing about Gaddafi, in Libya. I mean, but these are viewed as countries that are allied with Iran and the Soviet Union. I mean, excuse me, with Russia. And therefore, they're on the wrong side. And if you want to have hegemony in the region, you have to have pro-Israel, pro-U.S., pro-Saudi Arabia. That's the triad right now that they want to see dominating that region. Mm-hmm. And so that's I think what the view is. Now, the other bizarre thing about this is creating foment and wars and civil wars and tribal wars in the region is really also inconsistent with the U.S. trying to move so much force to Asia. You know, the Asian pivot, encircling China because it's becoming an economic rival, is also going on. And so it's really kind of crazy because they really don't have the troops to be in multiple wars in the Middle East and then also moving troops to China. So it's a very confused foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if they want, say, like half a war and maybe not a whole regime change, but let's just weaken Assad and then, you know, at some point somewhat call it off and go from there or whatever, they're in a real bad position now where even if they really wanted to do a peace deal, you can't bring Al-Qaeda to the table, right? I mean, even if you could somehow, you know, do a Skype conference call with Ayman al-Zawahiri and Prince Bandar and everybody, you're not going to be able to call off a bunch of suicide bomber prisoner beheaders. These guys are going to keep killing until they feel like they're done. Who can call them back?
A lot of that.
Who can call them to Geneva, Switzerland, to sit down at a big oak table and have a conversation about this stuff?
Well, That's an interesting image. A lot of that problem really is coming from Qatar and Saudi Arabia. They are the ones that have been funding the more extremist groups down there. It's not all that, but there's so many different factions. You can't even define them all. So I think they've created a very difficult situation to calm down, and they're probably just going to have to burn themselves out fighting, because I don't know. I mean, Saudi Arabia can withdraw its money. The U.S. is now, arming people in Syria with anti-tank weapons and with small arms. And this is so amazing. In a secret vote, the U.S. Congress approved arming some of the factions, and the moderate, so-called moderate factions, in Syria, with small arms and anti-tank weapons. A secret vote for a war policy. That's just, to me, is so incredible. The way they did it was part of the NDAA, and I guess parts of that law are secret. Mm-hmm. And so that was voted on by the Congress in secret.
Well, and what moderates among the rebels in Syria? There never have been. I mean, the closest thing they had to moderates was the Al-Farouq Brigade, because they wanted to hold elections rather than just have an outright dictatorship of the imams or whatever the hell. And yet the Farouq Brigade, that's the cannibal guy, was from the Farouq Brigade, the guy eating the guy's heart or liver or whatever in the face.
I know.
So those are your moderate. And the Free Syrian Army, the New York Times even says the Free Syrian Army quit existing back the end of December.
Right.
It fell apart completely.
And yet the United States is now arming so-called moderates based on a secretly passed law. Bizarre. What a crazy country we are.
Yeah, it is. It's ridiculous.
I mean, secretly passed laws? After the Congress, stops in a military attack on Syria because the people responded so aggressively from across the political spectrum, saying, no, we don't want another war. And the Congress said, okay, we won't do another war, and stopped Obama from going forward. Then they have a secret vote after that to arm factions in Syria. I find it just be totally bizarre. But then again, we've had this secret negotiation going on for, 4 years now for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to give us economic hegemony over the Asia and the Pacific. Mm-hmm. And that's been done in secret. They plan to try to pass it through Congress without Congress really seeing the law in any serious way. And so, it's just this democracy has gotten so strange, and calling it democracy is getting harder and harder.
By the way, real quick at the end here, can you talk a little bit about that the torture report put out by the government of Qatar and Christian Amanpour on CNN?
Oh, man.
At the dawn of this. How skeptical are you about those pictures there? What is all that?
Oh, I think I'm totally skeptical. There was a really excellent article in the Christian Science Monitor by a reporter who looked at it. He said that this was a one-source report. He had one source for it, and that source was anonymous, and has been part of a group that's been trying to overthrow Assad since 2011.
And they even admit much of it. So for all we know, these are pictures of Bahrainis being tortured by American tax dollars.
And the other thing that's so weird about it is it was so rushed. 3 days after they interviewed this guy, the report was finished. And, of course, it's paid for by Qatar, which is one of the biggest antagonists to Assad in the region. So it all adds up to something that needs to be looked at very carefully and questioned very closely. How do you verify where pictures came from, who's doing the torturing, who was tortured? And the exaggerated numbers, they only looked at a small percentage of the photos before they issued the report, and the number 11,000 was extrapolated from a very small percentage. So it's 11,000 is a guess figure, on top of this being a rushed report written based on the one anonymous informant. So I think there's lots of questions about it. The timing obviously was set, so it'll be the beginning of the Geneva conference, the peace conference, and so they got the kind of propaganda they wanted to get out before the conference started.
Man, that Christian Amanpour, any other story with a single source like that, like say if it was to, lie us into war with a country that she didn't want bombed or something, she would never go with such shoddy sourcing.
She's gotten terrible.
Are there any countries that she doesn't want to bomb? Maybe I set up a false premise.
She's become such a warmonger. It's really pitiful. And CNN has had a drumbeat for war in Syria now for a couple of years. They've been one of the most aggressive networks pushing for war in Syria, so it's very hard to trust them. Of course,
Oh, we should mention here, too, about how they've had to back away from their claims about the rocket attack from last August. And no, they couldn't have been fired from 9 kilometers away, more like 3, and that's rebel territory.
Exactly. And now they've hired the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, who is a former American citizen who renounced his citizenship, so he can become the ambassador from Israel to the United States. Now they've hired him as a commentator so they could bring some balance
Michael
Oren, there.
Right? Yeah, he's the guy who said last October, yes, I prefer Al-Qaeda to Hezbollah. That's why you prefer Al-Qaeda to Hezbollah in Syria, because Hezbollah's backed by Iran. Same guy.
Well, thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you, Kevin. I sure appreciate it.
All right, and have a good time.
You too. Everybody, that's the great Kevin Zeese. ComeHomeAmerica.us. Find him on antiwar.com tomorrow, this Syria piece. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins. CashIntoCoins.com makes it easy and 100% anonymous. Just deposit the money into their account at any Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or credit union with shared branching, and then just email them a picture of the receipt with your Bitcoin address and you get your Bitcoins. A simple, clean, anonymous way to get Bitcoins. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, this is where I interview people and complain about stuff. Thanks for tuning in. Again, apologies for the last couple of days worth of technical problems. Complete destruction. Total disaster. Day before yesterday. And then yesterday, yeah, it was pretty lousy too. Talked to Mark Thornton. That was cool. Anyway, so check this out. A couple of people, I think, have called me out for, I guess, not really using this as a kind of talking point very much when I go retelling the history of the neocons and the terror wars and all of these things. And I guess it's a good point. This is a good talking point. It's the kind of thing that people would remember happening, maybe. I could go, hey, remember that when this happened? And they go, oh, yeah. You know, it's a good point. And so anyway, here's the clip. And then when we get back, I'll talk a little bit about what this is about and what's so important and all that. But it's General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, the guy who almost got us into a war with Russia in 1999 when the Russians took the Pristina airport, a very cheeky move. Clark wanted to go to war with them. And the British general, Sir Michael Jackson, said no. Belay that order. Do not obey the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Why, he would get humanity extinct if you listen to him. So just so you know, it's not like he's a good person or anything just because I'm playing a soundbite of him. He's actually perhaps quantifiably the worst person ever to exist, or right up there with anyone who ever would have killed all humans or gotten them all killed by killing the wrong ones at the wrong time. Anyway, General Wesley Clark, March 2nd, 2007, he was at the something called the Something or Other Club in San Francisco. I forgot the name of it. The Fancy Pants Club? The Commonwealth Club? Maybe it's the Commonwealth Club. I'm just going off the top of my head. It's been a few years now. But here, listen.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me in. He said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No, no." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, "No, no." He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office, today. And he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
So go through the countries again?
Well, starting with Iraq, then Syria and Lebanon, then Libya, then Somalia and Sudan, and then back to Iran.
All right, so those are, well, first of all, the first thing that's got to be said is that Wesley Clark didn't tell us this. He found this out in the fall of 2001, and he didn't come out and try to warn us about what was going on. Here's the former Supreme Allied Commander in NATO. He certainly understands the import of what he's being told. He certainly understands that all these different countries are not run by Osama bin Laden and ain't got a damn thing to do with Osama bin Laden. And what did Wesley Clark do other than make some smart investments and help lie us into war? In fact, I'm trying to remember now. 2002, wasn't he one of the generals? In fact, wait a minute. Well, no. See, Barton Gellman did this great thing for the New York Times one time where he finally went back and explained about how all the generals that lied us into war with Iraq on TV, the retired generals, how they were all working for Rumsfeld, and he was giving them briefings full of lies every day, and they were coming out and selling us the war, and then they were... It wasn't Barton Gellman. It was at the New York Times. Anyway, wait a minute. Let me find this. New York Times, generals, Iraq, say CNN... Yeah, here you go. Behind TV analysts, Pentagon's hidden hand, it's Barstow, David Barstow, and he won a thingamajig for this, man. He won a Pulitzer for this. And now, I have to go through it, but I think that, you know what? I'm thinking of Barry McCaffrey. I don't know if Wesley Clark was in this. Anyway, Wesley Clark sure as hell didn't warn us. Here he is in 2007, he's finally spilling the beans on this, and of course, you know, getting some yucks and all that in the audience. But anyway, so what is this policy? What is this agenda? Well, there's a couple of things. From a strictly American imperialist point of view, these are all countries that we don't control. They are not all just loyal satellites of the American Empire, and so no one is allowed to be on the outside. That's just the rules. You'll be assimilated. It's as simple as that. But then also, you'll notice North Korea wasn't even on the list. These were all of Israel's enemies. And the reason for that is that the neoconservative movement in America is, in effect, simply a covert action campaign of the Israeli government, sent to infiltrate our media and lie us into war against Israel's enemies. And I mean, in effect, I don't mean they're all outright agents of Mossad, the neoconservatives, just that they might as well be. They don't care about America. They only care about Israel. And in fact, that's not even right. They only care about themselves and about the interests of the right-wing nationalist parties in Israel, which is quite a bit different from the interests of Israel, if that means the land with all the people who live on it and, you know, what's best for them as a whole kind of a thing or anything like that. And so, here's the deal. Go back to the 1990s, and you can find, right after the first Gulf War, the defense planning guidance by Paul Wolfowitz, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's one of these neocons too, and Scooter Libby. They were the ones who wrote it for Dick Cheney, and it says that America will be the world empire forever now that the Soviet Union is gone, and we will never allow any near-peer competitor, we will never allow any nation or group of nations to even think about trying to arm up enough to be able to challenge us. We will kill them way before they even get the idea to try to assemble enough power to challenge us. That's it. We won the game for world state. It's based out of North America, and you're going to do as you're told. Never mind the UN Security Council, we got the National Security Council. That was what it said. And of course, what are all their prime targets? Israel's enemies. Just kind of a coincidence. And then in the 90s, when it was the Clinton era and the neocons were out of power, they centered at the Project for a New American Century, and they put out, well, first of all, in 96, for an Israeli think tank, they put out two studies signed by Charles Fairbanks, Douglas Feith, Richard Perle, but written primarily by David Wurmser. And these are A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm. And then the companion piece is called Coping with Crumbling States, but it's about how to crumble states and then cope with the aftermath there. And then they wrote Rebuilding America's Defenses, which is about, you know, building up America's offensives and expanding the American empire to bases across the Middle East and to conquering America's enemies. And so when Wesley Clark tells that story in 2007 about what he heard in 2001, what he heard was the neoconservative coup d'etat. Basically, that's what happened after 9/11, was that Scooter Libby and Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith and Abram Shulsky and David Wurmser and John Bolton, who's actually not a neocon, he's just a regular con, but he's very close with those guys, they had their little cabal. Colin Powell called it Douglas Feith's Gestapo office, the separate government created within the government. That it was in his words, a coup over the government, in Colin Powell's words, a coup over the government, as these neoconservatives who put their loyalty to Ariel Sharon and his policies first, put all this together and said, this is what we'll do as the response to 9/11. And you'll notice, in fact, just put in Ariel Sharon in that very same list that Wesley Clark rattled off, and there's Ariel Sharon telling Bush, commanding Bush, to carry on to Iran, to Libya, to Lebanon, Syria. Poor Somalis. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show. And by the way, I actually went to link to A Clean Break. Or no, it wasn't A Clean Break. It's Coping with Crumbling States, the companion piece by David Wurmser about regime change in Iraq and Syria, written in 1996. And it's the Israeli Advanced Strategic Institute for Studying Things, or some crap. I forget the acronym, man, but it's this Israeli think tank, right-wing nationalist think tank in Israel. They were the guys that Wurmser did the study for, and A Clean Break and Coping with Crumbling States have both been on their website all these years, but I tried to get to them the other day, and I got a 404. I don't know if that's permanent or not, but I went ahead and went to the Google Cache, and I copied and pasted both articles. The Coping with Crumbling States is much longer than A Clean Break. But if you just go to scotthorton.org/fair use, scotthorton.org/fair use, you'll see that the last two articles I've added are Coping with Crumbling States and A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm. And what happens when you read those is you get into the mind of the neoconservative hawks in 1996. And this was, in fact, A Clean Break, perhaps both of them, were written as policy papers, advice for Benjamin Netanyahu when he was becoming the prime minister for the first time, the Likud prime minister back in 1996. And they were saying, hey, welcome to office, Mr. Prime Minister. Here's what we suggest you try to get done. And in a word, it's get America to overthrow Saddam and Bashar al-Assad for you. Because, yeah, then we'll all have, there'll be Hashemite kingdoms everywhere, and the Iraqis will love it. It'll be great. And yeah, they'll build an oil and a water pipeline to Haifa, because Ahmed Chalabi promised. He promised. All right, well, If you're not familiar, I'm sorry. Ahmed Chalabi is the Iranian spy who lied the Israel First American neocons into war with Iraq. They're the guys who lied you into war with Iraq. And this is kind of the ultimate punchline to the neoconservative fiasco of the George W. Bush years, to me, is that not only did everything not work out at all like they said it was going to, like they believed it was going to, but what they believed in the first place was so self-evidently stupid it couldn't have possibly been. And the guy who was selling it to them, their best friend. I mean, go back and look at Richard Pearl and Danielle Pletka and all these guys palling around with Ahmed Chalabi. Their best guy was working for the Iranians. That's what was going to be the plausible outcome of overthrowing Saddam. Not a Hashemite king and an oil and water pipeline to Haifa, no. But the Shiite Arabs at Ayatollah Sistani's word will take the South up to, through, and including all of Baghdad. And of course, you know, Chalabi to this day, I think, is the minister in the, it's something. He switched around. He was the oil minister for a while there. He got his cut. But yeah, then the CIA and the DIA, now maybe they were just pissed off. But the CIA and the DIA, I guess they never did leak the report, but they leaked the results of the report to the media. And they said that they had concluded that Ahmed Chalabi was not just working for himself, he was working for the Iranian government. And the Iranian government had a policy, the Iranian intelligence agencies had a policy of going ahead and encouraging Chalabi to lie the American Israel Firsters into Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein for them. And you know what makes me mad? Maybe someone in the chat room can help me out with this. I was never able to find it again, but I swear to you I read it. I could have sworn it was at Slate, but I never could find it there again. But I swear to you, I read somewhere that, and it was good sourcing, high-level sourcing, that when David Frum wrote the, I should stop tapping my pen on the desk, on the paper here, I'm sorry, I'm making a bunch of bad noise into the mic. When David Frum wrote the Axis of Evil phrase, accusing Saddam and the Ayatollah of being in an axis together, that it wasn't really Frum's phrase after all. It was Richard Pearl. Of course, Richard Pearl is the guy that Frum co-wrote his book, An End to Evil, with, which makes Frum Pearl's lickspittle. But this was not like a, I don't think, here's what I remember about it. It was not some, you know, left-winger or libertarian being very critical and accusing, you know, and saying, oh, I think Richard Pearl did it, not Frum. It wasn't like that. You know what it was? There was a controversy about Frum's wife bragged to everyone on her email list that, yeah, my Frummy boy, he was the one who wrote the Axis of Evil line accusing Saddam and the Ayatollah of being in an axis together. Yeah, way to go. Anyway, so that's what made it a big topic of discussion. Who was the ghostwriter who put that Axis of Evil phrase in there? In fact, there's another part to the story that I can never find again that maybe you guys can help me find, if you're master Googlers. And that was that the phrase originally included Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Syria, which you can now call them an axis of Iran, but was hardly true then. But they called Iraq, Iran, and Syria the axis of evil. But then it was too obvious that this is just Ariel Sharon's wishes. That there's nothing more here other than what does Israel want America's foreign policy to be. And so they changed Syria. Not, they didn't take it off the list of people to be, you know, killed and bombed and regime changed, but they on the list for the speech, they changed it to North Korea. Right, because now Kim Jong-il Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollah are all in an axis together. Well, I guess just like World War II with the alliance between the Germans, Japanese, and the Italians, only without any alliance. You're just lying. But anyway, for some reason, I have always believed that it must have been Richard Pearl who put that in there. Yeah. We gotta say, in this speech, that we can never deal with Iran or Iraq. They're so far beyond the pale. War is our only choice. Madness. All right, anyway, so there's the background. Here's your footnotes. A clean break. You can find it at scotthorton.org/fair use. A clean break. Oh, first of all, defense planning guidance, 1991. A clean break. Coping with crumbling states. Both of those by David Wormser. And then rebuilding America's defenses. And then really read as much as you can. I think there's still a PNAC. Man, you know what? I bet the PNAC site is down now. I think it is down. Maybe there's a mirror, a clone. Somebody tell me there's a mirror of the PNAC site, because they had such great archives of all of their pro-war propaganda from the time leading up to the invasion of Iraq. It's really, you know, was a great resource for a long time there. Certainly, you can find Rebuilding America's Defenses in other places if you look around. It's not that easy to find, but add PDF to your search, and you'll probably get it. But anyway, and then, you know, another good thing might be to combine all those keywords together in your searches and see who's written really great articles and or books about all these things. Like, for example, James Bamford wrote a book called A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. That one's a reader. In fact, here's a couple more footnotes for you. These are all about how Ariel Sharon created his own Office of Special Plans in the office of the Prime Minister of Israel. Because as much as the CIA and the Mossad are liars and happy to lie you into war, they couldn't quite come up with enough bogus, enough bullcrap to lie us into war with Iraq in a timely enough fashion. And so in America, they created the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon. And in Israel, they created the Office of Special Plans in the office of the Prime Minister. And according to James Bamford in A Pretext for War, and according to Julian Borger in The Guardian, in his article, The Spies Who Pushed for War. And they're not really spies. He's talking about the neocons. The Spies Who Pushed for War is the title of the article. And then there's Robert Dreyfus in The Nation, an article called Agents of Influence. And all three of those talk about the Israelis manufacturing fake intelligence in English to lie us into war with Iraq. Oh, and in fact, here's one more footnote for you there. Karen Kotowski, and she's written about this in other places, but certainly if you go to theamericanconservative.com, that's the American Conservative magazine. You need the on there, theamericanconservative.com. Go there and search for Karen Kotowski. She wrote a 3-part series for them back in 2003 called In Rumsfeld's Shop. Oh, I always forget the middle one. In Rumsfeld's Shop. Something, something. And then the third one is Open Door Policy. And if you read Karen Kotowski's article, Open Door Policy, you'll see that is a reference to Israelis having open access to Douglas Feith and his office at the Pentagon. And she tells the story of she was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force at the time. And at one point, she was supposed to escort these people down the hallway to Douglas Feith's office. And they just walked ahead of her, leading her, escorting her. And barged right in. Hey, Doug, here's what we're going to do, pal, kind of a thing. Now, no, she doesn't say that. I added that. But barged right in, walked right in like they own the place. They did. Fact, here's a fun fact. Doug Feith's law partner, Mark Zell, specializes in representing settlers on the West Bank. Colonists. More great complaining after this. Hey y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. but how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all. Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Conscientious objector. That's the second article. In Rumsfeld's shop, conscientious objector and open door policy. That's the Karen Kotowski series from 2003 in the American Conservative magazine. Good stuff for if you like knowing stuff. You know, another good one about the neocons lying us into war would be The Lie Factory by Jason Vest and Robert Dreyfuss in Mother Jones. That was a really good one based in great part on what they were told by Karen and what she saw these neocons do, lying us into war. Right in front of her face, working there in the Pentagon. Right in front of our face, too. I mean, I got to tell you, those of you who supported the war back then, who say, like, hey, everybody thought he had weapons of mass destruction, everybody this and that. Actually, it turns out that 50% of the American people, that is 150 million American people, knew better. Now, once it was the eve of war and they were going to war anyway, then everybody's saying, oh, yeah, support the country, support the troops in their dangerous mission, and blah, blah, blah. But before the war, it was a 50-50 thing. And honestly, I think mostly here was the 50-50. The people who knew that Saddam didn't do 9/11 and the people who thought he did. And most of the people, I'm not talking about the liars, I'm talking about the lie-ees. Most of the people who thought he did do 9/11... they kind of made that up themselves. They might have heard it implied here or there. And there were some neocons in the media, you know, talking about the Czech Republic meeting and all this crap all the time, which totally wasn't true. I remember well people basically just filling in the blanks themselves. In fact, Colonel Sam Gardner called it the excluded middle. This is what George Bush would do. And you can find so many examples of this from, say, the year leading up to the Iraq War. People would say, and Bush would ask himself rhetorically and then answer, why Iraq? Why is it so important that we attack Iraq? I mean, the fact that it was taking him a year to lie us into it kind of belied the fact that it was a real emergency, you know? Oh crap, now I forgot what I was going to say. Too many tangents. Let's see. Bush would ask himself, why do we have to attack Iraq? And then he would say, because it's such a unique danger. I'm sorry, man. I blew it. I got looking, spacing out off too many tangents. The excluded middle is what it was. How Bush lied us into war. Why do we have to attack Iraq? And Bush would answer, because of September 11th. And then there would be a massive pregnant pause. Because of September 11th. 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 Mississippi. Because on that day we learned that from now on we have to start all the wars rather than waiting around for anyone to start a war with us. That was the lesson of that day. Can never let anyone ever attack us because look at how bad it is to be attacked. Really bad. So from now on, preventive war is the order of the day. But didn't it sound for a minute like he said Saddam did the attack? Why do we have to attack Iraq? Because of September 11th. I'm sorry I spaced out and screwed that story up. It would have been a lot better thing if I had not screwed it up. But I'm still right, and that's still what I mean. And in fact, I think it's Kevin Zeese interviewed Sam Gardner, the colonel from, Psychological Warfare Division, explaining this is how they did it. They would just leave it up to you to kind of figure out, well, George Bush is kind of an idiot. He's not always very well spoken. I think what he meant to say was that Saddam knocked down the towers. Isn't that what he was saying? We have to attack Iraq because of September 11th? That's what he's saying. And people just, they fill in the gaps themselves. Try to somehow make it make sense. Why would we take a guy who's basically an atheist, Saddam Hussein. Does anybody think Saddam Hussein actually had a religion at all other than himself? Come on. Here's a guy who's an atheist, minority, military dictator in a precarious spot, barely holding on to power as it is. He's going to start palling around with a bunch of suicide bombers? This guy whose entire history was hunting down and killing people like that? This guy who, at the moment of the invasion, had an APB out for al-Zarqawi. If you find this guy, shoot him. Wanted dead or alive. The leader of Ansar al-Islam. The guy who ended up becoming the head of al-Qaeda in Iraq and helping to precipitate the civil war that killed somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqi civilians there during the occupation. So they're lying, and they knew they were lying, but that was working. You know, I was a cab driver at the time, and I couldn't tell you how many people were just outright buying it. And, again, with the excluded middle, they just kind of make up all the excuses themselves, you know? I remember a guy in my cab saying, yeah, of course, Saddam did the attack. And I said, no, dude, he did not. And he said, well, it doesn't matter. What do you want to do? Just wait around till he attacks us? And I said, well, one, yes, of course. You know, start a war. That's what the dastardly Japanese did in World War II. That was morally wrong of them. Not just because we were the victims, but because, you know, murder's wrong. Starting a war is the highest war crime. Everybody knows that. America's courts of justice after World War II, they proved it by hanging Nazis. They did. You're guilty of aggression. And then out from under you goes the trapdoor, Nazi. So, yes, of course, let Saddam attack us first. But, by the way, he's not going to attack us. He's never going to attack us. And as I was mentioning yesterday, talking about Paul Pillar, even the CIA, NIE, said they thought he had chemicals, but that he would only ever use them if the 3rd Infantry Division was rolling toward Baghdad. He might deploy them to try to defend Baghdad. Not he's going to give them to Osama, and Osama's going to spray you with a remote control plane that you need to protect yourself from plastic and with plastic and duct tape from. And then it didn't matter. That was the point. He kept arguing. Nope, still got to attack Iraq anyway. Well, reason number one, not true. Reason number two, not true. Reason number three, I don't know. Doesn't matter. Don't need one. Want to. And I remember another guy in my cab. I've mentioned this guy a lot. Who this guy had just absolutely made it up. That the official position of the U.S. government was that Saddam had done 9/11. And I told this guy, I've mentioned this a lot of times in the past, sorry if I'm wearing a hole in your eardrum here, but the guy was a rich guy. He lived in a really, really nice apartment, one of those townhousey type things, but where the very rich, single businessmen type dudes live, you know, trendy thing, Maserati type. Rich guy, well-educated, and not just in his own business, but in the world. You know, I talked to him. A capable adult who woulda, coulda, shoulda known better. And I told him, no, dude, go and look. George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, George Tenet, all of these guys, go and look. None of them have ever said Saddam did it or that they think Saddam did it. You made that up in your own brain. To try to come up, and this is before the start of the war, you made that up to smooth over your cognitive dissonance. But just ask yourself simply, if Saddam did it, or if George Bush thought for a moment that Saddam did it, tell me why we haven't been bombing them for the last year. Why in the hell are they going with their hat in their hand asking the French and the Russians to approve on the UN Security Council? They didn't ask the UN Security Council if it was okay to invade Afghanistan, because under the rules, you can defend yourself, dude. You need UN security authorization to start a war and not get hanged. At least, you know, according to the letter of the law. Not that the American state isn't above the law, but you understand. But still, no matter, this guy, the cognitive dissonance is just, hey, it's just easier to believe that, geez, if I identify a little bit Republican, and I prefer the Republican types, and they want to have this war, then I want to have this war. And if all the reasons I came up with for why I want to have this war are all bogus, well, damn it. But I want to have this war, so I'll just, whatever, keep believing it anyway, or keep pretending I do, or I'll make up some other reason. Oh, I heard that Saddam moved all his weapons of mass destruction to Syria with the help of Vladimir Putin. And so, therefore, it was a good war after all. Never seen a shred of evidence of that. But I heard that somewhere from, yeah, the same people who told me to invade in the first place. But in fact, you know who was one of the major liars behind that lie? That Saddam's weapons of mass destruction actually existed in the year 2003 and that he moved them to Syria? It was James Clapper, the current director of national intelligence. The guy who has sovereign immunity, like a king, from prosecution for his perjury, which is a felony. I guess Bill Clinton proved that. No, perjury is not a felony if you're a government employee. Only if you're a mundane do you go to prison for perjury. Anyway, yeah, James Clapper, the perjurer, he was the perjurer behind the whole weapons went to Syria lie, too. But people, man, they'll just rationalize whatever they want. They'll rationalize whatever they want. You know, the problem is what happens sometimes, people get to rationalize some crazy things, and then they learn a new fact out of left field, like their uncle thinks this is all a big stupid lie, and they go, whoa, someone that I have respected my entire life thinks that this is all completely crazy? I can't call you Michael Moore, huh? Or something like that happens, right? Some kind of black swan thing happens. Where the defenses all of a sudden have to drop. And hey, wait a minute. What if Bill Clinton and George Bush and Barack Obama are the lowest scum of the earth ever? And that anything that they do is corrupt and rotten and evil and soaked with blood-soaked money. And maybe this whole thing is an evil, corrupt empire. Maybe each and every one of these sons of bitches are lawyers. The worst people in the world. And maybe we don't owe them any deference. And maybe their security forces that they lord over us all day actually aren't legitimate. And maybe all those men wearing black robes just make them a bunch of guys in dresses. Who actually there's nothing legitimate about their pretended authority whatsoever. Hey, maybe we don't need these guys. Right, most people don't take it that far. We sure as hell don't need the empire. And what's good, though, is I've seen some hardcore warmongers snap out of it. So that means there's hope for the lot of you, too. Am I out of time already? Oh, no good. I still got a quarter hour. I'm going to try to lecture less and rattle off some news more here after this break. I got some important stuff for you here. It's the Scott Horton Show. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And listen, I know it's a fine line. I ain't trying to sound like all Mr. Know-it-all or whatever. That's a pretty bad attitude to have. But I do know some stuff, and it's stuff that I think is real important about how, you know, our government is our enemy. They hate us. And, you know, I just figure as much as I can. It ain't a know-it-all thing, but as much as I do know, I feel like I want to try to provide a place where people can come to find out the truth about why these things are happening, why it is that our government is what it is and does what it does. That's all. You know. Just so that in case you're inclined to not believe them, you have a place to actually go so that you can know better. And of course, my number one priority, as you can tell on this show, is always to bring you the people who I think are the best journalists who, in whatever given week, are doing the best journalism on the most important subjects of war and peace so that you can hear from them. And that's why I know as much as I know, is because I get to cross-examine all the journalists all day long and all the lawyers and professors and whoever's. So, and I get to test out my understandings against their understandings and hopefully refine my own and get them better. But so anyway, you know, I don't want to sound like all, oh, I'm telling you all this stuff, but actually I am, but it's only for people who want that. Okay, that's what it is. You want somebody to tell you a bunch of stuff, then yeah, that's this show. I tell you a bunch of stuff. ScottHorton.org is the where I keep the archives there if you want to know more stuff. All right. Now, executive orders. I just want to make this point real quick about executive orders. When liberals are in power, liberals think executive orders are great, and conservatives are a bunch of stupid jerks for objecting to such a thing. And when conservatives are in power, they think executive orders are just great. And the liberals are a bunch of namby-pamby, whiny, whatever, because they're not the one who's the president right now. And hardly anybody's got any principle. Way down here at the bottom, I guess. There are those of us who have principle. Like, hey, if this national government is going to exist at all, they have to obey the rules as outlined in the Constitution, the first law of the national government, where all the rest of their powers are derived from. And the first sentence of the Constitution ain't "we the people." That's just the cover sheet, kids. The first sentence is all legislative powers belong to the Congress. It does not say at the beginning of Article 2 that, oh yeah, also, and the president can do what he wants too. It doesn't say that. And all this stuff about, well, I'll just use executive orders because I can, and the federal bureaucrats will obey, and what's the Congress going to do? Impeach me, and so, yeah, and get away with it. That's not law. That's like the law of the war. Oh, whatever we conquer, we win, and what are you going to do about it? But that's not law. That's the absence of law. And in the 90s, it was Paul Begala, who's still one of these talking heads on TV, but he used to work for Bill Clinton, said, oh yeah, stroke of the pen, law of the land. Pretty cool. And then, you know, he disagreed with that vehemently for 8 years during Bush Cheney somehow. But now I'm sure if you ask Paul Begala, he would say, hey, look, what's Obama going to do? Wait around for Congress to pass laws making things legal? Hell no. And that is because, it is because of the empire. It's because, as Garrett teaches in his great essay, Rise of Empire, in the People's Pottage, he says, well, of course, the president is predominant in foreign policy. So if he can make foreign policy the predominant issue, which whenever there's a war, it's the dominant issue, then he gets to aggrandize power all to himself. It's like in the James Madison warning. And if you stay at this for a long time in a row, what ends up happening? The judges and the legislatures and the people, their power becomes less and less and less relevant to the form of the state. So now pretend I dream a genie comes, abolishes all of the terrorists in the whole wide world. Now still, what are you going to do with this massive homeland security state that you built? You know? You're going to be stuck with it. So, seems like, you know, it's important to resist. Otherwise, you end up giving up everything that you thought is what made this place the place where you're from and where you want to live. Right? Bill of Rights? Basic stuff like that. You want to still have a Bill of Rights or no Bill of Rights? It's the empire. And that's why the president can get away with ordering all these things by executive order, is because he orders things by executive order all day long when it comes to the foreign empire. Why not go ahead and get things done? Hey, did you ever see that? This is me covering the news, not lecturing. Isn't that funny? Did you ever see that Gina Davis TV show that they made? Gina Davis, who's the redhead lady from some Bill Murray movie in the 80s or something. But they brought her in back in, say, 2006, 2007 to do a show where she becomes the president of America. And, of course, the whole thing was to try to brainwash you and butter you up for Hillary Clinton. But the premise of all 4 or 5 episodes of that crappy show, I only saw 1 or 2 of them, but I heard about the rest. The premise of every one of them was, she's got to be a very tough, masculine woman and assert hardcore, total executive power so she can be a strong leader, or else all of her other wonderful agendas will become subsumed. So she has to be a strong leader on everything else, too. And this is so funny because it's just like what a bunch of Democrats want you to think is the way things have to be kind of a thing. You know, it was really funny. But in every episode, it was like, damn the law. You know, like she's 24 combined with that's my Bush or something, you know. There is no law. We got to get it done only for the Democrats. That's my Gore would have been. Anyway, executive orders, man, they're problematic because if there's any legitimate, assuming the Constitution's legitimacy for the sake of argument, if there's any legitimate use of executive orders, it's things like close Guantanamo and bring those guys here. That's within the president's authority to command troop movements. Bring them here, hand them over to the attorney general's men, and then let the law take care of it from there. That would be an executive order. But hey, let's change all the rules for how not U.S. government employee activities and actions, but how Americans have to live. Legislative matters about how we live our lives, that's not supposed to be up to him. And of course, as we can see, Barack Obama, just like the rest of these guys, they never use their power of discretion for good. Jake Tapper today from CNN, he's airing an interview with Obama where Obama claims that it's not within his authority to change marijuana from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3 drug on the DEA list. A Schedule 1 drug means like heroin or cocaine, which this isn't true for either of them either, but, or MDMA, which is also on the list. This isn't true about them either, but that they have no medicinal use. Is untrue in each and every one of those cases. Not that they're all necessarily the best thing for whatever ails you, you know, or safe from abuse, but still. And then whatever other, you know, lying qualifications make pot supposedly as dangerous as crack. Jacob Sullivan at Reason wrote a thing about it, verifying that Jake Tapper was right in the premise to his question to Obama. Hey, you're on the record, Mr. President, saying that pot is as dangerous or even is less dangerous than alcohol. Well, so why don't you schedule it as a Schedule 3 drug instead of a Schedule 1 drug? And he denied he had the authority to do so. He tried to pass it off to Congress or to, and then Tapper says, no, it's the DEA that decides, and he just deflects from there. As Jacob Sullum writes, here's a guy who talks about his government like he doesn't have a thing to do with it pretty often, and maybe that's deliberate, where he talks about, well, you know, the NSA guys, I'll talk to them, see what they're going to do. Like, what do you mean, what they're going to do? What we're going to do? What we're going to do? You're the guy in the chair, jerk. You're the guy who can tell them that they're fired if they don't do what you say, man. What do you mean, what they're going to do? And he does that all the time. Oh, geez, I'm only the president of the United States of America, the chief executive of every government department. How am I supposed to make the DEA reschedule pot on the list? Huh? And this is the same week where he's saying, if Congress doesn't want to go along with me on XYZ and all these other issues, then I'll just go ahead and use my executive orders and do it my way. Give me a break, man. It's just like Chief Wiggum. I used to have this soundbite. I have it somewhere. Chief Wiggum saying, I said we're powerless to help you, not to harm you. Yeah, good point. Powerless indeed. Oh, yeah. And, man, check this out, guys. Real quick on Iran, clock ticking on me. I'm such a bad broadcaster. The poll says, give me the numbers, 60% of American adults approve of the interim deal with Iran. And then check out, here's the headline from AP so that you can go read the all the context yourself. Deal to curb Iran's nuclear program holds support even if it might not work. So they're asking the American people, you know, well, what do you think if, you know, it doesn't work? And they're more talks. More talks, not war. More talks, don't bomb them. So that's really important. And then on Afghanistan, check this out. There's a thing at hightail.com. If you go to my website, scotthorton.org/stress. scotthorton.org/stress. And there's a link there to an interview by some other radio host. I don't even know. Pardon me, I'm sorry. I don't even know who it is. But he does a good job interviewing Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. Remember, I interviewed Gareth Porter on, what, Monday, right? About this? How Daniel Davis, beginning in 2009, then again in 2011, and now again, is writing about the failure of America's war in Afghanistan. And this guy that interviews him, he's kind of a right-wing Republican sort of a guy with his premises, you can tell, but is, you know, he conducts an excellent interview with this guy. If you go to my website, scotthorton.org/stress, you can find it, or just Google interview Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. It's really good. All right, see y'all Sunday morning and or back here Monday. Or at stress.